It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Welcome to episode 699 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for WrestleMania Sunday, April 11, 2021. I am the Solo Monster, a very bleary-eyed Solo Monster who did not get much sleep. We had a rain-delayed WrestleMania, and we went live until probably 2 o'clock in the morning last night talking night one. I think by the time I got to bed, it was about 3:30. And up and at 'em this morning to do 699 because I'll sleep when I'm dead. That was pretty much my catchphrase coming into this week when I saw all of the different streams, all of the different shows that I was planning on doing. But I want to say thank you to all the people, 3,000 strong, who joined me last night live, even for a later stream for the WrestleMania 37 Night 1 review, which is up right now on YouTube. I've also pushed out the audio to the feed, so you should be seeing that as well. But give the video a like, give the video a view on YouTube. Over 50,000 views so far, and that number is only climbing. You guys were amazing last night, all the support, all the super chats and everything, so I want to say thank you. And why don't we just get right into it here, because I am very tired, and there is a lot of work and preparation to do before night two. We got one more night of WrestleMania coming up tonight. And I'm going to talk about WrestleMania here in a second. Show some love for Audible. If you want to get a free audiobook, audibletrial.com/solomonster is the link to use. You can get one free book of your choice. And if you cancel your free trial, that book belongs to you, courtesy of the Sound Off. So audibletrial.com/solomonster, get one free audiobook. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, dropping some major love this week. Paul, I hope all is well with you and the fam. Josh Bad Medicine Medina, who told me that he really loved last week's episode of This Week in Wrestling History. Boy, that was a whole journey in itself, getting that thing done. We got four parts of that up last week on YouTube. I had to upload an entire separate episode of The Sound Off, a bonus episode to the feed last week, just to get through 20-plus WrestleManias this week in history. And this week, we didn't have 20, although we do have a few WrestleManias to get through. We got another packed history segment this week. Some fun things in history actually happened this week. Some events that you may remember, some events maybe that you're not as familiar with. It's coming up a little bit later on. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Rolex Robin Party, Max the Axe Velotto, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, and Giovanni the King Zarate. He's always showing a lot of support on the YouTube channel. Giovanni, I appreciate that. Shout out to Chris from Bethlehem and his beautiful bride, Angelina, who are celebrating 6 years together today. And a very happy birthday to Chris from State College, or should I say Chan. Your lovely girlfriend told me that you're turning 33, and my birthday wish is that 33 turns out much better than WrestleMania of that same number did a few years ago. WrestleMania 33, on the whole, was not a great show. So I hope you have a better birthday than that. Check out Chuck's Cantina, hosted by your barman himself, Chuck, where anything and everything is up for discussion. Grab yourself a beverage. Listen as Chuck and his weekly guests talk all things news, entertainment, sports, and life. And coming soon, they've got NFL draft reactions, a review of the new Godzilla vs. King Kong movie, which I still haven't seen. a WrestleMania review, and later this month, the Snyder Cut review, where Chuck will drop his own pipe bomb on why Warner Brothers with DC Comics is like Vince McMahon with WWE. That does not sound good. Listen on Spotify, iHeartRadio, iTunes, Amazon, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. For more information, you can follow at Chuck's Cantina on Facebook and on Twitter. We're going to have more shouts here in just a little bit. Things kicked off on SmackDown Friday night. They had a fatal four-way for the SmackDown Tag Team Championship with Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode retaining over Otis and Chad Gable, the Street Profits, and the team of Rey and Dominic Mysterio. That was a match that would have fit in, I thought, very nicely on either of the two nights of WrestleMania. Of course, hindsight now, looking at how things turned out, I would have taken that match over that women's tag team turmoil match that we had last night. I thought the match on Friday, though, was a lot of fun. I thought it was all action, and Ziggler and Roode retained the tag team titles, and we had Jey Uso. Main event Jey Uso finally won something on his own. He won the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal, a very forgettable Battle Royal as it is every year. In all honesty, the only Andre Battle Royal that I ever really cared about, and that kind of felt special and had this great finish to it, was the very first one they ever did. That Cesaro won back at WrestleMania 30, and even that turned out to not mean much of anything. So it's hard to care. It's just a way for them to get guys on the show, and it didn't even matter this year because the Andre Battle Royal was in the Thunderdome taped a week ago. It wasn't even part of the actual WrestleMania card, so, you know, they would have been better served, I think, to just skip this year again. Would have been two straight years of no Andre Battle Royal, but they still haven't quite figured out how to make it meaningful, which is too bad, because it really wouldn't be that hard. We had stellar promo work on Friday night. If you missed it, it is worth going back before night two tonight if you want to get yourself pumped up for the main event. To go check out the promo work at the beginning of SmackDown from Daniel Bryan, in the middle of the show from Edge, and even the stuff at the end with Roman Reigns, but I thought Bryan and Edge especially really knocked it out of the park on Friday. They are putting out some of their best promo work. Edge was on Talking Smack. He had a segment with Paul Heyman. The man is unhinged, and he is laser-focused on winning the championship and kind of culminating this comeback story for himself at WrestleMania. I thought he was just, on another level from everybody else. Him and Bryan were on Friday night. Really got me even more excited than I already was, frankly, for the triple threat match tonight. And, you know, on the live stream that I did on Friday, I floated an idea. And I wanted to broach that here on the show. Kind of a what if for the SmackDown brand. And I put this to you to see what you think. What if the camera crew that has been following Sami Zayn around now for the past few months, they've been filming this conspiracy documentary that is now premiering. But what if this camera crew that's been following him around, filming everything backstage, you would think that Vince McMahon would have learned his lesson after Beyond the Mat or Wrestling with Shadows to not allow documentary camera crews to wander around in the back. But what if they accidentally filmed some other things completely unrelated to Sami Zayn? Because they have all of this footage. And what if in that footage there was stuff filmed that led to a completely different storyline, and some of you were kind of intrigued by the idea. And I had just thought of it while I was watching SmackDown on Friday, so I hadn't really had the chance to flesh it out too much. But I thought there's something there. And then Big Snow, on Twitter, after hearing me talk about it, he helped flesh an idea out a little bit more that I really like. And what he said is, what if they caught Sonya Deville at various points over the last few months plotting her takeover of the SmackDown brand from Adam Pearce? And maybe you have Sonya on camera, you know, huddling at different points with Edge. She's off in the corner talking to Seth Rollins. She's with Roode and Ziggler, the SmackDown Tag Team Champions, all of whom Sonya has argued on behalf of on television at various points. Could be a new group. You know, could be a new faction forming. I mean, we have enough of those in AEW. We don't necessarily have an overflow of them in WWE. Maybe coming out of WrestleMania as they push that storyline forward. They're doing something. They're building tension on television between Sonya and Adam Pearce. It's just a matter of where it is leading to. But maybe that could be an idea. Maybe there is a new group, or maybe again it's just her trying to plot her ultimate takeover of the brand, where she becomes effectively the de facto general manager of SmackDown. That would at least take this camera crew stuff that Sammy has been doing, and it would actually give it an additional purpose here beyond Sammy's storyline. It could tie into something completely different. Some quick night one impressions from WrestleMania. I thought overall it was a strong show night one, with the women's tag team turmoil match really being the only negative. I thought that was the only real blemish on the show. It was a very bad match. The Riot Squad, they were the best thing in the match. Fortunately, they didn't win. But that match was a complete and total mess. Even right down to the ring announcer at one point during one of the eliminations botched the elimination call. Liv Morgan had pinned, I believe it was Dana Brooke, to eliminate Dana Brooke and Mandy Rose. And Greg Hamilton goes, "The Riot Squad has been eliminated." And then 3 seconds later, he had to correct himself. Of course, Mandy had that moment where she slipped and she fell on her ass on the ramp. And she was, you know, she put something on social media later about how embarrassed she was. And Titus O'Neil came over to give her a hug. Titus knows what it's like to kind of fall down. Although he didn't fall on his ass. He fell straight down on his face and slid. Like he was trying out for the Mets. But it was very wet outside from all the rain. But just everything about that match, it was just no good. I thought it was very nice to have the fans back in the audience to see WrestleMania back in its natural habitat as compared to what we had last year. It's one of those things where you don't know what you got till it's gone. Yeah, you build up to this big show every year. And, you know, what we had last year was pathetic. I mean, they worked within the confines of what they could. They did the best they could with it, but that's not WrestleMania. So it was nice to have that back for the first time in 2 years. Unfortunately, with that natural habitat, being outdoors in an open-air stadium like that, you are at the whims of Mother Nature. And we ended up with the first ever rain delay in WrestleMania history, which delayed the start of the show by 45 minutes. So what they did was they scrambled. And they were trying to just kill time by having various wrestlers do unscripted, unplanned, impromptu interviews. Very unlike what you are used to seeing in WWE. Everything is usually, I mean, maybe without the top stars who are allowed to at least go off the cuff a little bit more. But for the most part, they obviously script everything out. And you have to, here's your verbiage that you have to memorize. And you can tell because the people who are reciting this junk, they don't believe what they're talking about. That's why a lot of the promos in WWE suck. And it's not even that some of these people are terrible promos, but in some cases they're not given any good material to work with. Well, here, they just had to kill time, so they put a microphone in their face, and it's sink or swim. You know, they kind of threw them to the lions. Braun Strowman was kind of stammering and stumbling all over himself, but even Strowman, you know, Kevin Owens did well, and you could kind of tell who did well with it and who didn't. Seth Rollins, I thought, did very well. But even the people who maybe were a little off and were stuttering and stammering, there was a certain authenticity to it. You know, they came across as actual human beings instead of robots who kind of look off into the distance. So I liked it. I wish that the show didn't get delayed by 45 minutes because I ended up starting my stream 45 minutes late. I didn't like that. But I would like to think that this could potentially lead to them loosening the handcuffs a little bit, but they have their way of doing television. I really don't see that changing. I was pleasantly surprised by the finish to the WWE title match. Bobby Lashley winning with the Hurt Lock, putting Drew McIntyre out, winning via ref stoppage. I was hoping Lashley would win. I expected Drew to win. In terms of Lashley winning, I didn't expect it to go down that way, and I thought that was the right way to go. I think Lashley deserves more time with this championship. He deserves more than 6 weeks to kind of see what he can do with it and what other people he can work with. I think that Drew McIntyre might be destined for SmackDown. You know, I don't know if they're planning another roster shakeup, and if so, when. I could see Drew landing on the SmackDown brand. And as far as what happens with Lashley, you know, we were talking about it on the feed last night, and I got some Super Chat questions about Brock Lesnar. And do I see them bringing in Brock Lesnar to challenge Bobby Lashley? Not right away. That's a match that if you were going to do, I would save it for SummerSlam. So you're going to need some opponents for Lashley to work with between now and then. And maybe he does another match with Drew in the meantime. But Lashley and Lesnar, if ever there was a time for them to do this match, it would have been A, when Lashley first came back to the company. But B, given that they never did that, Lashley has never looked as dominant as he does right now. Lashley just went to WrestleMania as a heel and successfully defended the WWE Championship. You can count on one hand the number of heels who have gone to WrestleMania to successfully defend their title. It's not something that happens a lot. If they're going to do this match with Lesnar, I say build it up as a big main event at SummerSlam. Cesaro picked up his first singles win at WrestleMania. I hope they keep that push going right into a Universal title match. Cesaro against Roman Reigns, Cesaro against Edge, Cesaro against Daniel Bryan, which we've seen on television. We know that obviously is going to be a great match if they do that. Any of those three who come out victorious in the main event tonight, you could put them in the ring with Cesaro and have him as the next number one contender for the championship. Otherwise, this push is all for nothing. Just got a win at WrestleMania over Seth Rollins, an established name. You had Kevin Owens wrestling Roman Reigns three different times, TLC, cage match on SmackDown, last man standing at the Royal Rumble. If he can get three matches, there's no reason Cesaro can't get at least one. Very happy to see him pick up that first singles win. Speaking of first wins, at WrestleMania we had Omos making his in-ring debut, the bodyguard of AJ Styles. He and AJ are the new Raw Tag Team Champions. I thought Omos looked fine in his debut. I think he'll be best in small doses like that. They kept him very limited in what he did. It was only his first match. Now I guess they have the Shawn Diesel thing going as Tag Team Champions. How soon before AJ accidentally forearms him? And then 3 days later, Omos pins Bobby Lashley at Madison Square Garden in 8 seconds to become WWE champion. Not trying to will that into existence, but, you know, Vince McMahon, sometimes he sees something in someone and he just latches onto them as the guy. And then after Omos wins the WWE title, Vince McMahon can turn him into a smiling babyface who's destined for failure. He's done that too. We had Braun Strowman and Shane McMahon. Shane McMahon took the obligatory big bump at WrestleMania. He got tossed off the top of the cage. Took a hellacious bump down to the ring below. He bounced. I thought that was fine. I thought the end of the match was fine. The match itself, I could take it or leave it. I'm just happy this feud and hopeful this feud is finally over. And Shane McMahon can take his 6-month absence now from television. We had Bad Bunny with Damian Priest. Bad Bunny was the talk of the town this morning. He was the talk of the town last night, too, during the pay-per-view. A lot of people very impressed with his first match. And I thought that he did a fine job. He obviously put the work in. He didn't want to go in there and embarrass himself. He didn't want to go in there and embarrass the people he was working with. He's a genuine fan. And he looked like somebody who certainly was not in his very first match, so that's a credit to whoever was training him down there at that performance center. Credit to Miz and Morrison, I said this last night, because I think they're going to kind of get lost in the conversation here. People can praise Bad Bunny all they want to, and he looked good. You know, he looked crisp in what he was doing, even his selling. He was selling better than half the people they have on that roster who do this for a living. But don't sleep on Miz and Morrison, because this match is not as good as it was without them. They were with him every step of the way. They helped this guy look like $1 million last night. And they deserve a lot of the credit, I think, for how well that match came off. Absolutely. And Damian Priest, hopefully he'll get some shine out of this too, because unlike Bad Bunny, Damian Priest, he is full-time. He is a new star they can build around, I think, on that Raw brand. You know, they don't have a wealth of top babyfaces on Monday Night Raw right now. So if they're not going to do a draft or a shakeup anytime soon, they really should start building up Damian Priest to be somebody who could challenge Bobby Lashley in a few months for the WWE Championship. You know, I normally wouldn't say to kind of rush him into that position, but they don't have a lot of guys who would fit in that spot. Now is the time to start building him up the way they had started to build up Keith Lee before, you know, his whole push went sideways. I saw pictures of Keith Lee. He was at WrestleMania with Mia Yim. So he's around. You know, he didn't look hurt. Again, I still have no idea what's going on with him, but hopefully we'll have Keith Lee back on TV very soon. He could be another one that you build up, if not for a match with Lashley. Certainly, I think if Sheamus were to come out of tonight, the new U.S. champion, since supposedly the plan was to put the U.S. title on Keith Lee and not Matt Riddle. If we get Keith Lee back soon and Sheamus is the champion, you've got a program right there. As soon as Keith Lee comes back to TV, he could challenge for the U.S. title. But as celebrity matches go in this company, this was one of the better ones that they've ever done. I thought this was a really enjoyable tag team match. And then we got the main event of Sasha Banks and Bianca Belair, only the second women's match to headline a WrestleMania. I enjoyed this a lot more than I did the first women's main event they did back at 35. I thought this was an excellent match. I thought both women, they killed it last night. It lived up to the billing. It's the match that I was hoping they would do months ago. They did it. They delivered. The hair whip, I hadn't even thought about that. That was such a great spot in Bianca's matches in NXT. It was to the point, though, where it's like, okay, she needs to not overuse that spot. But she really hasn't used it at all, hardly, since she came to the main roster. And I wasn't even thinking about how the hair whip might fit into the finish of this match, but she whipped the shit out of Sasha Banks. Sasha had this welt, this long welt on her midsection, and picked her up for the KOD and got the pin to win the women's championship. Michael Cole botched the call there at the end. He thought that Sasha Banks kicked out. They showed a replay. At no point did it look like Sasha Banks kicked out. It wasn't even close. But somehow Michael Cole saw something that the rest of us did not see. And so now his call, his botched call, will forever be part of Bianca Belair's first title win. And Sasha Banks keeps that reverse Undertaker streak alive. Her WrestleMania record moves to 0-6. Poor Sasha Banks, right? 0-6. But she was able to get her first WrestleMania main event. I'm sure she's perfectly content with that. I loved it. I love the main event. We'll see if Roman and Edge and Bryan blow it out of the water tonight. Or, you know, maybe not. I think it's going to be very hard for them to have a bad match. I'm expecting that to be the best match of the night. That's the match I'm looking forward to most here on night two. But the full review for night one is up on YouTube right now. I was up, like I said before, until 2 o'clock in the morning streaming and reading and answering your super chats, hanging out with everybody. It was a lot of fun. And tonight we get to do it all over again. Tonight we get the encore. Tonight is also the Stone Cold giveaway from WrestleRumble.com, and I will be hosting the live drawing on YouTube immediately following Night 2 of WrestleMania. We're going to pick one winner at random to receive the Stone Cold Steve Austin Legacy Belt. Only 500 of these have been produced. Comes in a nice, big, fancy black case with the belt inside. This thing weighs around 40 pounds. This thing is a monster. This ain't no cheap shit. Only quality from Wrestle Rumble. And all it costs for you to enter is $1 for your chance to win. Enter as many times as you like, but you only need to enter once for a shot at it. But you need to hurry, because the cutoff time for entry is tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern, right up until WrestleMania hits the airwaves. And there have been a bunch of other giveaways this week. Wrestle Rumble has given away over half a dozen different championships. You know, last night was also the Legends of WrestleMania belt giveaway. I was able to host the contest on the live stream. That was a custom-made belt, beautiful belt. And I think Wrestle Rumble will very possibly be planning more of those in the future. I'm not clued into all the plans yet, but the gears are going. There could be some cool stuff coming up in the near future. But go to WrestleRumble.com. You can get in on the contest tonight. It is the final contest of the weekend. Here is the rundown for WrestleMania Night 2. Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler defend their women's tag team titles against Natalya and Tamina. I've got Nia and Shayna to retain. Matt Riddle defends the United States Championship against Sheamus. I kind of look at this as them maybe giving Sheamus something of a consolation prize because, boy, you know, he went from working with Drew McIntyre and potentially contending for the WWE title to not really having a whole lot to do on WrestleMania this year. So I think Sheamus is going to win the U.S. title. And if he comes back very soon to TV, I think he's going to feud over the title with Keith Lee. That's my extended prediction. Kevin Owens takes on Sami Zayn. Logan Paul will be at ringside. He'll factor into this match in some way. I don't know if he'll be standing at ringside. I don't know if he'll be in the front row. I don't know if he'll be on commentary. Sami's corner. They haven't announced. But I'm picking Kevin Owens to win because Sami Zayn, he loses. I mean, that's what he does. He loses. Kevin Owens is going to win, and Kevin Owens, I'm hoping, will also drop Logan Paul with a stunner. We have Big E defending the Intercontinental title. You talk about fiery promos from SmackDown on Friday night. Give some credit to Big E. It's the best promo work of his life in that video, hyping up the Nigerian drum fight against the challenger Apollo Crews Intercontinental title on the line. A Nigerian drum fight is something Apollo says his ancestors created for those who are wronged to be able to make things right. No rules, no limitations, just a beating so loud it sounds like a drum. As I said on Friday, if he wants Big E to know what it feels like to be beaten like a drum, he should have just introduced him to Ricochet. Could have saved himself a lot of trouble. Apollo Crews should win this. I don't know what the point of turning him and giving him this whole new persona. This is his stipulation. He picked the stipulation for the match. All things are pointing to an Apollo Crews win. Big E is going to move on to bigger things. Big E is going to be challenging for the Universal title before this year is out. Maybe even by SummerSlam. Him losing the Intercontinental title does not do him any harm. He had to win the title to get to this level. The Intercontinental title has always been a stepping stone, going back decades in this company. Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, Randy Savage, Steve Austin. This has always been a stepping stone championship. Jericho, I mean, you can go up and down the list. So if Big E loses tonight, as I think he will, it's not the end for him. It's the beginning of something even greater. And Apollo Crews will finally get that win under his belt. He loses again. I mean, he's pretty much done for as far as a serious contender. I don't know where he goes from here if he doesn't win the championship. He's already wrestled 4 or 5 times for it, and he's been a failure up until this point. So this whole new attitude adjustment and everything else, I mean, what is the point of any of it if at some point he does not win the big one? So Apollo is my pick. Asuka defends the Raw Women's Championship against Rhea Ripley. This is the other match I'm really looking forward to tonight. We had one women's title change last night. I think we're going to get another one tonight. Go all the way with Rhea. Do not play around here. She is going to be the face of that women's division on Raw, or at least she'll fight Charlotte Flair for it. Because you know Charlotte will always be around. There's a history there with her and Charlotte. If Rhea wins, there's a natural storyline that they can move on to coming out of WrestleMania with Rhea defending the championship against Charlotte Flair. Only this time, hopefully the outcome is different than it was at WrestleMania 36. Rhea Ripley should win that women's title. Asuka has done an admirable job as the champion. She has done all she can to try to keep that title relevant. They haven't done her any favors the last few months, ever since her program with Bayley and Sasha came to an end. She's a woman with really nothing to do, nothing going on. I mean, they've really dropped the ball, frankly, on what they could have done with Asuka here in this title reign. It's Rhea's time to shine. I say give it to Rhea Ripley and just run all the way with her. We have Randy Orton one-on-one against The Fiend. Bray Wyatt. He's not a fan of their WrestleMania match a few years ago. There is no stipulation attached to this match. They'll be limited in the magic and the special effects they can do now that they're in front of a live audience. I'm sure Alexa Bliss will play into this match and play into the finish in some way. This man was burnt to a crisp by Randy Orton on pay-per-view a few months ago when Randy Orton won the Inferno match. The Fiend has now returned. I really believe the WWE views Randy Orton in this feud as the heel. Now, I don't know if that makes The Fiend a babyface, but if that makes Randy Orton a heel, well, the heel gets his comeuppance tonight because The Fiend really needs to win this match. If The Fiend can't beat Randy Orton now, then what next? The man was burned alive, and he came back. Tonight, The Fiend gets his revenge. The Fiend goes over and he beats Randy Orton. And Roman Reigns defends the Universal Championship in the main event against Edge and Daniel Bryan in a triple threat match. Plausibly, any one of these three can walk out with that championship tonight. Roman Reigns should be the one who leaves with the title. I'm not ready to see this run end quite yet. He's got more names, more opponents lined up coming out of WrestleMania, whether it's Cesaro, whether it's Big E, whether they shake up the rosters and somebody else comes over from Raw like a Drew McIntyre. You can do individual matches coming out of Mania with Roman and Bryan, Roman and Edge. There's a lot of possible opponents and possible programs left for him. I think Edge and Bryan being in there, they kind of cancel each other out. And I'm picking Roman Reigns to win. I would not be surprised if any of these three walked out with the championship. But I have to go with Roman Reigns. My head tells me pick Roman Reigns to retain. Night two, I think, looking at this card on paper here, night two absolutely could give night one a run for its money. Night two may end up being a lot better than night one was, and I didn't think night one was bad. You know, I looked at some of the matches on this card, and it's a strong card. Let's just hope the rain and the lightning stay away. Right now, I looked before I started recording here, it's looking like a 70% chance of rain tonight with scattered thunderstorms. You know, if it's raining or it's drizzling, the show will go on. The reason that they stopped the show and they told people to seek shelter was because of the lightning. So when you're dealing with lightning and thunder, that's where it gets dangerous and you have to stop the show. So if we can just avoid that, then hopefully we can get through night two without any rain delays. And WrestleMania can actually wrap up at around 11 o'clock. That would be nice. It would be nice to be able to go live on YouTube before midnight. WWE's biggest two-night event is upon us in Tampa, Florida, and to celebrate this historic event, DraftKings, an official gaming partner of WWE, is putting you in the center of the action with $25,000 up for grabs for their remaining free-to-play contest this weekend. The first $25,000 contest came and went with Night 1 of WrestleMania now in the books. That's $50,000 total this weekend. And playing for your share of that is easy. Just download the DraftKings app, sign up using promo code SOLOMONSTER, and enter DraftKings' free-to-play WrestleMania pool. There you'll answer questions like who's going to make a surprise appearance or who's going to walk away victorious. The players with the most correct answers will get their share of the $25,000 in prizes that is still up for grabs tonight. DraftKings has paid out over $7 billion to its players since 2012, so they know a thing or two about big paydays. Download the DraftKings app now and use promo code SOLOMONSTER to enter the free WrestleMania Prediction Challenge with $25,000 up for grabs. That's promo code SOLOMONSTER, and you can win big in today's free $25,000 WrestleMania contest only at DraftKings, an official gaming partner of WWE. Terms, conditions, and eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. We've got some news on a potential shakeup to the Monday Night Raw announced team. Apparently, Adnan Virk will be taking over the play-by-play role on Raw starting this Monday. That's according to a report from Wrestling Inc. Virk will be replacing Tom Phillips, who has been handling play-by-play for Raw since the beginning of last year. Virk is a Canadian sportscaster. He worked previously for about 9 years, up until a couple of years ago for ESPN. There was a bit of controversy. He was fired from ESPN, allegedly for leaking information to the media. So he was involved in that little dust-up a few years ago. I don't know what he's been doing of late. He might have been in Canada the last couple of years. I think he was on The Score. But Andrew Zarian of the Mat Men podcast chimed in. He confirmed the report from Raj Geary at Wrestling Inc. and said that the changeup for the Raw announce team is going to see Adnan Virk doing commentary with Corey Graves and Byron Saxton. Corey Graves has been doing commentary on SmackDown on Fox with Michael Cole. So my hope is that if that's true, it's not going to be a case of Graves pulling double duty again. Maybe Michael Cole is going to get a new partner. Maybe Michael Cole is going to get Samoa Joe. If Samoa Joe's not coming back to the ring, he was doing commentary at WrestleMania last night. Maybe Joe is going from Raw to SmackDown. It's just speculation on my part. I don't know that to be true. I still don't know why we need a three-man announce booth. But apparently they're going to stick with that format. So Tom Phillips, this is very interesting. Tom Phillips may well be gone from the company. They're being very tight-lipped about this right now. He's not even listed. I checked. He's not even listed on the Raw announce page anymore. On the, Raw roster page. Even Vic Joseph is on there in the Monday Night Raw section. And he hasn't been on Raw in months. He's on NXT right now. They have Vic Joseph on there. I didn't see Tom Phillips. So obviously something happened. He was not there last night. He was not even mentioned last night. I suspect he will not be there tonight. So something obviously happened here. We just don't know what that something is yet. Not only is it not looking good for him on Raw, I would say it's not looking good for him in the company. And it may not be a bad thing. It may not turn out to be a bad thing at all. You know, to get a fresh voice on the show or someone who actually might be allowed to show some real personality. I am not familiar enough with Virk's work to say how good he is or not, but hopefully he's able to bring some of that, some personality to the show. The problem is, you could say that, you know, Vic Joseph and Tom Phillips and all these people would have, you know, a wealth of personality. They're just not allowed to really show it. Vince McMahon has his way of coaching his announcers, so you can have all the personality or all the charisma in the world as an announcer. It may not make a difference. He likes his announcers to speak and act in a certain way. And I don't see him breaking away from that formula right now. So it may just be a case of, you know, interchangeable parts. You go from one guy to the next and, you know, they all have their own unique voice. But in the end, if they all do commentary the exact same way, then what difference does it make? You know, here we're talking about Adnan Virk coming to Raw. In 6 months, it might be somebody else. Remember when they initially shook up the Raw announce team and they had Vic Joseph with Dio Madden and Jerry Lawler? That didn't last very long. They didn't give Vic Joseph and Dio Madden a lot of rope before they hung themselves on Raw and they got rid of them. And then it was on to the next team. So based on history, this may just be a temporary arrangement, but I am most interested to find out exactly what happened with Tom Phillips. Because there's something going on here. I watched the WWE Hall of Fame on Tuesday. For me, it was nearly ruined by the fake piped-in crowd chants. I thought that was completely unnecessary. You know, I was fine with the idea of there being no actual fans for a change. But I have no idea why they didn't have the wrestlers out in the audience like they usually do during these ceremonies. You know, when they used to do these at the hotel banquet halls in the early years, they had limited fans there, but they had wrestlers. The wrestlers were at, you know, the tables. They were in the audience even back then. If they can't bring their families, yeah, I get that, but they were already there. The wrestlers were on the red carpet. They were giving interviews. Why not have them sitting out in the audience? I just don't understand that. So between that and the piped-in chants, it almost completely took me out of the whole ceremony. Of all the inductees we saw, I thought RVD probably had the best speech. That was probably the speech, honestly, that I enjoyed the most. And this was not without controversy. During the 2020 induction ceremony, you know, they honored the class of 2020 and the class of 2021. But during the 2020 induction ceremony, WWE announced Ray Stevens, Dr. Death Steve Williams, and Gary Hart among the names of their legacy inductees. That is definitely not the complete list. I thought I had the full list here. But in any event, those were the names that stood out to me. You know, Dr. Death, should he have or could he have gotten a solo induction instead of just being lumped in as a legacy inductee? Of course. But if you look at their body of work, even Ray Stevens, Pat Patterson pushed so hard for Ray Stevens to go into the Hall of Fame when they were in California a few years ago. He and Ray Stevens, one of the best tag teams, very well known in that Bay Area, and Vince McMahon wouldn't do it. Jim Ross, for many years, pushed to have Danny Hodge put into the Hall of Fame. Vince McMahon would not do it. And now Hodge recently passed away. I don't, you know, people try to figure out what goes on in the mind of Vince McMahon and why he makes the decisions he makes when it comes to these Hall of Fame inductees. There's no rhyme or reason for it. There's no sense in even trying to figure it out. So a guy like a Ray Stevens, Dr. Death, they all would be worthy of having standalone Hall of Fame inductions. But if WWE is not going to give them that, then this is as good as it gets. Then you lump them all in together. At least they get some recognition. For the 2021 class, we had Dick the Bruiser, Pez Watley, Buzz Sawyer, Ethel Johnson, and Paul Bosch joining them in the legacy wing. Wonder how Bruce Pritchard feels about Paul Bosch being lumped in as a legacy inductee. I believe he came up in the business under Paul Bosch. He's a big fan of Paul Bosch. I'm sure if it were up to Bruce, he would have been giving the induction. And Paul Bosch would have gotten a full-on Hall of Fame induction, but that's not how it works. You know, Kevin Dunn. Nobody will know who they are. We can't put him in the Hall of Fame because nobody will know who they are. That's how it goes. You know, that's what happened. That's what happened when Jerry Lawler went in. Can't have Lance Russell. Nobody knows who he is. Sorry, Jerry. Let's go with William Shatner. The reason there was controversy is because it was noted that the footage that WWE used for Ethel Johnson, who's credited as the first black female wrestler, footage they aired was not Ethel Johnson. Footage they aired was of a woman named Sandy Parker, who's a completely different wrestler altogether. And Ethel Johnson's niece was not very happy about this. She tweeted her displeasure. She said, "Y'all need to fix this, because if you're going to use my Aunt Ethel in the Hall of Fame, at least reach out to the family. And the video you used isn't her. Ethel Johnson was the first black champion ever. If you're going to represent her correctly." And that is almost as embarrassing as the Mets putting together a 50th anniversary tribute to their 1969 team and honoring all of the players that have since passed away, while including two people who are still very much alive in that tribute. It was news to them when they found out that they had died. And the Mets, I know they called at least one of them to apologize. I assume they called both people to apologize. You know, "Sorry, we thought you were dead." Now that was worse, because they actually thought these people had expired. But this reminded me of that, and I thought I would share that with all of you. One of the great marquee moments in Mets history. But yes, I don't know how something like this happens. This is what happens when you have people who work in the company who don't have a sense of wrestling history. And look, I didn't know anything about Ethel Johnson myself, but I wouldn't be the one putting together footage for her video package either. You know, they need to have people who actually know what the fuck they're doing. If you're going to be putting together video packages for these legacy inductees and you have limited footage, you at least need to know that you're using the right footage. I wonder who they have in charge of doing this. Probably Kevin Dunn. Hey, we have footage of this African-American lady. She looks like an Ethel. We'll just put that in the video package. It's very embarrassing. You know it's not embarrassing? Your support of this podcast. In fact, it's greatly appreciated. And I have to say thank you to some other folks here who contributed this week, including New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Eitan, the Executioner Zimmet, Ostentatious Alan Carter, the Wichita Workhorse Clayton Nettleton, the Firebomber Craig Foster, The Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, John Raging Mad Riffle, Sepia Prince, good to hear from him. Shout out to ABA from the Wrestling Hypothesis podcast. I met him at one of the SummerSlam meetups I hosted a few years ago. On his podcast, he and a group of lifelong wrestling fans debate and discuss all things WWE and AEW, and sometimes other promotions as well, like Impact and New Japan. They certainly have their unique opinions, and they are not shy about debating one another about them. It can get a little testy, can get a little heated, but that's what happens when you have a group of very opinionated people. They also have a separate YouTube channel with bonus content, including pay-per-view recaps and their secondary show, Wrestling Hypothesis Extra. Give the main show a listen. You can find the Wrestling Hypothesis podcast on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, Breaker, Radio Public, and on Google Podcasts. And finally, this week, Adam from FWCIETC on YouTube checks out some bloopers from The Office and finds out what it would be like if Mrs. Doubtfire was recut as a horror movie. And of course, an all-new episode of World Wrestling Strea. He is very proud of Bronson Reed, Indy Hartwell, and Tony Storm after their showings at NXT TakeOver. And he reviews all of the wrestling action figure reveals from Mattel over WrestleMania weekend, including the Hulk Hogan WrestleMania 9 figure that comes with an authentic black eye, as supposedly given to him by the Macho Man Randy Savage. I did not even know that Mattel made such a figure, but apparently this is a real thing. So visit youtube.com/FWCIETC or follow at FWCIETC on Twitter. And by the way, as far as NXT TakeOver Stand and Deliver, I did a night 1 and 2 combined recap on the YouTube channel, also pushed the audio out to the feed, so that should pretty much get you covered on all the major platforms. If you missed it, go back and check out my full thoughts on the NXT show. I thought that was quite good as well. Seth Rollins appeared on Ryan Satin's new Out of Character podcast, and he talked about working in front of the Thunderdome crowd as opposed to a live audience for the past year. And he had some interesting comments. This is what Seth had to say. He said, I still think social media plays quite a role in how shows are written and how characters are portrayed. The Thunderdome has allowed us to tell our stories a little cleaner in the sense that things aren't as up and down as they normally would be. Whether that's good or bad, I'm not entirely sure. I miss the fans and live interaction, but I like being able to cut a promo and getting all the way through without having to side-eye the audience. It's nice to get a thought out without being interrupted by CM Punk chants. I hope he realizes that by saying that, he can now expect even more CM Punk chants for his segments on Raw and SmackDown once the fans are back in the buildings full-time. I'm not sure why you would even draw attention to that if it bothers you so much, especially if you're a heel. You have to know that if you openly talk about it, you're only going to encourage more of it. You would think he would realize this. He continues on. Some stories have overstayed their welcome, but we've definitely been allowed to tell fully fleshed out stories over 6 or 7 months that we would not get through normally because a live crowd would force creative to change course. I had a blast working with the Mysterios, although things got carried away at the end. I was proud of the eye for an eye match. I would go to the live events and the response was not what you would see on TV. Crowds were two totally different crowds. At a live event, the crowd would be 100% pro Rollins and it was a party. Then we'd come to TV and the latter half would be down my throat. It's very confusing and sometimes I think it pushes our creative process in directions that maybe we shouldn't be going. But that's how the business is these days, and you gotta figure it out and adapt. Now, I saw some people riled up by his comments. He's right and he's wrong. He's right about it now being easier for guys to get through promos without having to pause every 2 seconds for the what chant. It's honestly the one thing I'm not looking forward to once crowds are back, are the stupid what chants. You know, it was fun for a time when Austin started doing it. Vince McMahon would play off of them well. Undertaker still has the greatest comeback of all time to the what chant. Hulk Hogan has the second best. They chanted what at him and he just goes, "Cha gonna do?" I always thought that was clever. Not as good as The Undertaker, but it was still clever. But after 5 years of it, it ran its course, and here we are 20 years later, and it serves no purpose. Absolutely serves no purpose. The punk chant is different. It is dumb, but I would argue that if you're constantly being inundated by CM Punk chants, that means that you're boring. And your audience is demanding that you don't bore them, and do a better job of giving them something to be entertained by. Give them a reason to care about what it is that you're saying. And if it's a writing issue, then it needs to be addressed from within. Speak up about it behind the scenes and address it from within. But if you're going out there and you're cutting boring promos, you can side-eye the audience all you want, CrossFit Jesus. You can side-eye me. You can side-eye everybody else. They're not going to give a shit about what you are saying. And Seth Rollins, during that entire Messiah run that he had, was the worst offender of them all. His promos were so incredibly dull. Even the empty chairs at the Performance Center couldn't stand him. But for the what stuff, you know, there is a trick to it that a lot of these WWE guys evidently have not figured out. And I don't understand why, because it's only been 20 years. But the trick is that you can shut them down by speeding up your cadence. Even Austin himself has talked about this. You speed up the cadence of your speech instead of pausing every 5 seconds and giving them an opening to say it. You know, a lot of these wrestlers have that overly scripted sounding way of doing their promos, so they take pauses. Like, this is what I'm supposed to do, or they're pausing because they're trying to remember what their lines are. This is one of the things that Seth Rollins doesn't seem to understand. And it's very interesting how this isn't really a problem outside of WWE. I'm not talking about the what chants, but, you know, like the crowds hijacking shows. It really only is a WWE problem. Now, I'm not saying it never happens anywhere else, but it really was only a recurring issue in WWE. Now, why is that? Why do you think that is? Learn to do a better job of countering them, and they won't be an issue anymore. If you keep pausing for them, they're never going to go away. But this was the facepalm moment right here in what he said. He talked about liking the fact that they have been able to tell more fleshed out stories without the crowds crapping on them, while admitting that his story with the Mysterios went on longer than it should have. He said things got carried away at the end with it. I would say things got carried away when they decided to give Rey Mysterio a fucking gumball for an eye and popped it out of his skull. Then he says in front of crowds, they wouldn't have been able to get through a story like that without the fans forcing creative to change course. That's what the fans are there for. It's too bad we didn't have fans in the building for that, because then they could have rightfully shit all over it because it sucked. That's what pro wrestling is. The fans dictate what works and what doesn't. You come up with the stories. You write the stories. The talent has to go out there and deliver, but the fans ultimately decide if it's good or bad. They decide what works and what doesn't, and they will not be shy about letting you know if it's bad. But now WWE, they have what they've always wanted. And this is my biggest fear coming out of this pandemic, as we slowly come out of these pandemic shows and go back to live audiences. That doesn't mean that they're going to stop with the piped-in manufactured crowd noise and chants. WWE, they have what they've always wanted. They get to make that judgment themselves. They take it out of our hands and they get to make the call. Vince McMahon and Bruce Prichard dictate what works now and what doesn't. And we see how well that worked out, especially on Monday Night Raw. The fans force creative changes when your creative sucks. Apparently, Seth Rollins doesn't like that. He says he misses the fans. That's what he says. He goes, I miss live crowds. Do you? Do you really? I mean, he makes a few good points here that I agree with, but man, does he come off as tone deaf with some of these comments. You know, in our system of government here in this country, we have three branches, and those branches exist as a check on the others. So no one branch has you know, too much power consolidated in that one branch. It's not a perfect system, but, you know, it does make sense, and it's good that we have it. We need the fans as a check on a lot of the stuff that this company over the years has been putting out. And I think if we've learned nothing else from this pandemic, we have learned that. You would think the talent would realize that and would want that. But apparently that may not be the case. We finally have a premiere date for Season 3 of Dark Side of the Ring on Vice TV, Thursday, May 6th. The season kicks off with a two-hour premiere dedicated to the loose cannon, Brian Pillman. Per The Observer, that will be followed by episodes on Nick Gage, Collision in Korea, The Ultimate Warrior, Grizzly Smith and the Smith Family, which includes Jake the Snake Roberts, and Dynamite Kid. And there will be a second half of the season airing later in the year, so they're apparently going to break it up into two parts. WWE documentary coming to Peacock soon. Just learned about this yesterday. Coming to Peacock and the network everywhere else. This summer, on Vladimir the Superfan. This was very cool to find out. This is the description of the documentary that is coming soon. The story of Vladimir tells the life story of Vladimir Abuzit, one of the most devoted and recognizable fans in WWE history. He came to Manhattan from Haiti as a child and quickly found his passion for living through the lens of sports entertainment. From the time I started watching wrestling in that late 80s period and watching a lot of those old Madison Square Garden shows, I can remember seeing Vladimir in those first few rows on almost every single one of those shows. And then over the years, the big WWE pay-per-views, whether it was at the Garden or even other places, there he was. He was always there. You know, today you have green shirt guy in the front row and long hair guy with his grandmother or whatever his mom or whoever these people are that we always see in the front row at these WWE events. Well, back then, it was Vladimir. He was one of the names that you saw at all of these events. And he had, you know, he has a very unique look. He had the glasses on. He always had the big muscles, you know, the muscular arms. He looked more cut than some of the wrestlers did. So he stands out when you see him. You know exactly who he is. I got the chance to meet him finally on Bourbon Street in New Orleans over WrestleMania 30 weekend. I felt like I had found Waldo. I was so excited to see Vladimir. But this is the type of content I like to see on the network. Today is also the drop day for the new Broken Skull Sessions with Chris Jericho. I am looking forward to watching that once this hell spawn of a weekend is finally over with. And I want to take a moment to acknowledge the death of Jack Veneno, who passed away on Tuesday at the age of 79 after a long battle with pancreatic cancer. He was best known for winning the NWA World Heavyweight Championship from Ric Flair in a match in the Dominican Republic back in 1982, which turned him into a cultural icon of sorts over there. I got to interview George Napolitano way back on Sound Off episode 182. I've gotten to know George quite well over the last 10 years. He's a great guy. I mean, George has been around. He has seen it all for decades. You think about every big WWE main event pay-per-view match over the years, WrestleManias, Royal Rumble, SummerSlams, Survivor Series. He's been there for most of them. He was ringside for the Montreal Screwjob. He didn't look like he knew what was going on. So George has been around for a very long time. And I asked him about this match between Ric Flair and Jack Veneno when I interviewed him. Because in Ric Flair's book, he name drops George. George has been friends with Flair for a number of years. Flair had no idea who his opponent was when he got there. And George was over there with him. He was there to cover the, you know, the matches. And he calls Flair and he tells Flair, hey, look out your hotel window. And when Flair does, he goes, there's your opponent. And outside his window was Jack Veneno. He was jogging around with thousands of people, you know, thousands of his fellow countrymen cheering him on. And he talked about how passionate and even dangerous things could be with the fans down there. And he was right in the middle of all of it, along with Flair. So you can hear him tell that story if you want. in his own words on episode 182. It's up in the archives. But Veneno was not supposed to win the championship. That's the interesting story here. It was supposed to go to a 60-minute draw. The fans, though, they were so hot for this match, Flair realized that if he had retained the title that night, he might not make it out of that building alive. He feared for his life. So he called an audible about 20 minutes into the match, and he told Veneno, hey, hit your finish and then lay on top of me and pin me. And when he won, the place, you could just imagine, the place came unglued. The title change was never acknowledged beyond that night. Flair ended up taking the belt back home with him. I believe in the Dominican Republic, they announced Veneno had been stripped of the title a few weeks later for not leaving the country to defend it. I think that was the excuse they gave. But to his people, he was the champion. You know, he won the title. He pinned Ric Flair in the middle of the ring. He was the champion who never lost. And, you know, you hear these stories, these old school wrestling stories, and you just have to appreciate how passionate these fans really were about pro wrestling and how much they believed. You hear stories like that about Puerto Rico as well. But if you're a heel and you're in the middle of all that, trying to make your way back to the locker room in one piece, and you've heard guys over the years, Harley Race, Ric Flair, Roddy Piper, they've all told war stories like this before. You're just trying to make it to the back. It's got to be just a terrifying experience. You know, wrestlers, they've had batteries thrown at them, urine thrown on them, they've been stabbed. You really did have to fight for your life. A few decades ago, private citizens used to be largely that, private. So what's changed? The internet. Think about everything you've browsed, searched for, watched, or tweeted. Now imagine all of that data being crawled through, collected, aggregated by third parties into a permanent public record, your record. Having your private life exposed for others to see was once something that only celebrities worried about. But in an era where everybody is online, everyone is a public figure. To keep my data private when I go online, I turn to ExpressVPN. Did you know there are hundreds of data brokers out there whose sole business it is to buy and sell your data? The worst part is that they don't have to tell you who they're selling it to or get your consent. One of these data points is your IP address. Data harvesters use your IP to uniquely identify you and your location. But with ExpressVPN, my connection gets rerouted through an encrypted server and my IP address is masked. Every time I turn ExpressVPN on, I'm given a random IP address shared by other ExpressVPN customers. That makes it more difficult for third parties to identify me and harvest my data. And the best part is how easy ExpressVPN is to use. No matter what device you're on, phone, laptop, or smart TV, all you have to do is tap one button to get protected. So, if, like me, you believe your data is your business, secure yourself with the number one rated VPN on the market. Visit expressvpn.com/solomonster and get 3 extra months for free. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. Go to expressvpn.com/solomonster to learn more.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we begin 58 years ago this week on April 11th, 1963, with the crowning of the very first WWE champion. Back then it was the WWWF champion, Buddy Rogers. Vince McMahon Sr. and Toots Mont, still a great name, withdrew from the National Wrestling Alliance, which McMahon later rejoined in 1971. But they left in protest after Buddy Rogers, then the NWA champion, had lost to Lou Thesz in January. And McMahon refused to recognize the title change, and upon forming the WWWF, he billed Rogers as its first champion. Now, the company claims that he won it in a tournament in Rio de Janeiro. There was no tournament. What is with them in these phantom Rio de Janeiro tournaments? There's a pattern here with this. But instead, he was given the belt on this date. And he defended it that night in a no contest against Bruno Sammartino at the Capitol Arena in Washington, D.C., Rogers did drop the belt to Bruno, though, 3 weeks later in a match that lasted less than a minute, thus starting a reign for Bruno that would last over 7 years. 39 years ago this week, on April 5th, 1982, was the famous match in Memphis at the Mid-South Coliseum between Jerry the King Lawler and comedian Andy Kaufman. Kaufman was a big television star at the time from the show Taxi, and an even bigger wrestling fan. This guy just got it. He got it. He understood it. He wanted so badly to be part of wrestling in some way. And he wanted to bring his intergender champion of the world gimmick to WWE. He actually approached Vince McMahon Sr. with the idea of doing this gimmick before he ever took it to Memphis. But Vince Sr. thought that it was too showbiz, and he didn't want that in his company. Imagine that. There's actually footage on YouTube of a ringside interview that Vince McMahon Jr. did with Andy Kaufman ringside at Madison Square Garden in the late 70s, where he is in total heel mode. He's talking about how he's offering $500 to any woman out there who can pin his shoulders to the mat. And he's talking about how women belong in the kitchen cleaning pots and pans and making babies. And Vince starts corpsing on the microphone. He seems to be very entertained. He was probably way more entertained by this than his father was. You know, if Vince McMahon had taken over from his father just a few years earlier, Andy Kaufman would have been the first major celebrity crossover in WWE. Long before Mr. T and Cyndi Lauper. I believe that 100%. Jerry Lawler says that Vince told him once that he was jealous of Memphis during that period because of the Andy Kaufman stuff. You know, if only he didn't die so young. He died a year before the first WrestleMania. I have no doubt in my mind he would have ended up doing at least an angle there in the company, maybe with Roddy Piper. This would have been maybe after WrestleMania. But after Piper's program with Hogan and the Hogan match had run its course, they could have turned Piper babyface maybe a little bit earlier. Imagine a Roddy Piper-Andy Kaufman feud on WWE television. But anyway, the night that he got rejected by Vince Sr., Kaufman went back to Bill Apter's apartment to talk some pro wrestling. And he just could not understand why McMahon was not interested in using him. Now, Bill Apter was friends with Jerry Lawler, and he suggested that, why don't we call him to make this big pitch? We'll pitch the idea to Lawler of doing something in Memphis. And so they did, and Lawler answered the phone. It was probably around midnight. He didn't even know if Lawler would answer. But he did. And at first, he couldn't believe that Apter had Andy Kaufman, the TV star, sitting in his roach-infested apartment in Queens. And Apter says, yes, I do. In fact, it is the real deal. And a few days later, Andy called Apter from Jerry Lawler's house. They were already making plans for what their feud would look like. And it all culminated in this match, which was included in the movie Man on the Moon with Jim Carrey. They packed the building, 10,000 people. Kaufman beat Lawler by DQ when Lawler used his pile driver, which was banned at that time. Not once, but twice. He gave him two pile drivers. And to sell the injury, Kaufman refused to get up. He told Lawler he would pay the $250 himself for a real ambulance. He wanted a real, actual ambulance, sirens and everything, to come take him from the arena on a gurney to the hospital. And in fact, that's what happened. The ambulance transported him to the hospital. In fact, as Andy Kaufman is being carted out of the building, if you look at some of the photos that were taken that night, you see standing right there in front of Andy Kaufman with the camera around his neck is a young Jim Cornette, who was there to take photos that night. Andy got taken right past him into the ambulance and over to the hospital. He spent 3 days with his neck in traction in the hospital while they ran all sorts of tests on him, not because he was really injured, but because he wanted to keep the work alive and really sell the injury. He was a better worker than a lot of the wrestlers we see today. 37 years ago this week on April 6th, 1984 in Waukesha, Wisconsin. This is one of my favorite stories. Ken Patera. He just wanted some burgers. That's all he wanted. He was staying at the Holiday Inn with Masa Saito after a show. I think they were still working for the AWA at the time. And the hotel restaurant was closed, and so he went out and he found himself a McDonald's. And he tries to go inside, only to be told by one of the workers there that they're closed. Now, he claims that what he sees are the workers inside. He claimed there was a television crew inside. They were filming a commercial, which sounds a little suspect right there. This is according to Patera's version of events, so keep that in mind. And he claims that he sees platters of burgers stacked up like a mountain, like a burger mountain, which sounds amazing. So he asks if he can get just 3 or 4 burgers to go. And they tell him, no, they've been out for 20 minutes, they're already cold, and we need them anyway for the TV shoot. So they wouldn't serve him. They wouldn't serve him. Patera got pissed off. He's starving. He starts cursing them out. He claims that all of a sudden, right, as he's outside this McDonald's late at night ranting and raving, that all of a sudden, a young kid who had been fired from that McDonald's just so happens to show up. He grabs this boulder, this giant rock from a rock garden that was nearby, and he tosses it through the window of the McDonald's, and he starts screaming, fuck them, they fired me. And Patera says that he looks at the kid and he goes, is that why you threw the rock through the window? And the kid says, yeah, and he takes off running. And Patera says he didn't think anything of it, and he just went back to the hotel to share the story with Saito. I don't buy that story for a second. I don't buy that story for one single second. That a random kid showed up at that exact moment. I mean, did the kid just hide in the bushes? Was he hiding in the bushes waiting for the right opportunity to come along? I love how this kid just randomly shows up at the exact moment. And he throws this giant 30-pound boulder. That's what it was. It was a 30-pound rock through the drive-through window. When at the same exact time, you have this giant pro wrestler standing right there who just so happens to be a weightlifter. He just so happens to be a shot put champion from college. And he's really, really angry. Oh, gee, I wonder who tossed the rock. I'm sure it was the kid. Larry Zbysko says that in the version that he heard, Patera was, not only did he do it, but I mean, Patera was even shouting that, you know, he was staying at the Holiday Inn, you know, hey, assholes, I'm staying at the Holiday Inn if anybody wants to come do something about it. That's how the cops knew how to find him. And when the two police officers showed up, that's when stuff really went sideways and the story becomes not so funny anymore. Saito answered the door. And what followed, according to one of the female officers in a story about the incident in the June 6, 1985 edition of the Milwaukee Journal, reads like this. She had only been on the force for a few months, so she was still relatively new at this job. So imagine her showing up and knocking on the door, and you've got these two giant, you know, pro wrestlers who answer the door. She claims that both wrestlers threw her from wall to wall, kicked her, kneed her in the back of the neck. She had 7 teeth broken, her appendix was ruptured, and she suffered a concussion. The other responding officer also suffered a concussion and had his leg broken. In all, it took 13 officers to pin these guys down and get them handcuffed. They had to use 2 sets of handcuffs and 6 officers just to restrain Saito alone. 4 officers ended up in the hospital. All this over some burgers. I mean, if it was their fries, I can understand. McDonald's has great fries, but their burgers? Both men were arrested. A year later, there was a jury trial. They were found guilty. They were sentenced to 2 years in prison and 6 years probation. When the verdict came in, the day that the verdict came in, Patera, Saito, and their lawyer were nowhere to be found. They held up the proceedings for over an hour. Turns out they were on the courthouse lawn drinking beers together, which got the lawyer a $250 fine. 35 years ago this week on April 7th, 1986, WrestleMania 2 was the first Mania to be available to a national audience on pay-per-view, and to date was the first Mania to be broadcast from 3 different locations in 3 different time zones. The Nassau Coliseum in Uniondale, New York, the Rosemont Horizon in Rosemont, Illinois, and the LA Sports Arena in Los Angeles, California. A combined 40,000 fans between all 3 venues. Bret Hart was told that he would be working a match against Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, and he was stoked. because he saw this as his big opportunity to really shine against a guy who could work. So he was very excited about this until 3 weeks later, when he got to the Boston Garden for a live event. He's going to have a tune-up match that night against Ricky Steamboat, which he did have. That might have been their only singles match. That was a match. I know it's been on one of the DVDs. It might have been Brett's DVD. But he gets to the Boston Garden for his tune-up match with Steamboat, and he was told that their WrestleMania match had been scrapped, and instead he would be in the 20-man Battle Royal, one that saw a mix of WWE stars and NFL players, something the NFL would never allow today, or at least their contracts would not allow it. That match is the only reason William the Refrigerator Perry is in the WWE Hall of Fame. In fact, this show is also the only reason why Ozzy Osbourne just went into the Hall of Fame this week. The British Bulldogs beat the dream team of Beefcake and Valentine for the tag team titles. Mr. T beat Roddy Piper in a boxing match, and Hulk Hogan beat King Kong Bundy in a steel cage to retain the WWE title. I believe Tommy Lasorda was there doing ring announcing duties. I mean, they had celebrities galore up and down this show. Ray Charles sang America the Beautiful. Joan Rivers was there. Joe Frazier. Even G. Gordon Liddy made an appearance. G. Gordon Liddy just passed away, I think, about a week ago. 2 weeks before this show, with all of the publicity for the show out, Jesse the Body Ventura saw an opportunity for the boys to unionize. He told Steve Austin on his podcast a few years ago, "The advantage was ours. I stood, I waited so there weren't any agents around. I stood up in the dressing room and I gave a speech to the boys, and this was at the time we were still battling Crockett Promotions. And I said, if we get together and simply tell the media that we are not wrestling unless union negotiators by federal law come in and give us the opportunity to unionize, I said, guys, the people that turn on the lights in these buildings are union. They have to do it by law. It's in our favor. Then, if we engage the Charlotte guys to do the same thing, we can have a union in wrestling. I gave this big speech, left it all out there, and I went home. The next night, I got a phone call from Vince McMahon basically threatening to fire me if I ever brought it up again, and he read me the Riot Act. And then I did WrestleMania 2 and immediately left and did Predator and became a member of the Screen Actors Guild, my union that I get retirement from now, healthcare from, all of that. When I came back, I told Vince point blank, I will not ever bring up a union again. If these guys are too stupid to fight for their rights, I have my union now. I'm a member of the Screen Actors Guild. I get healthcare. I get retirement. I get everything from them. I'll pay my union dues. And years later, when Ventura sued Vince McMahon over unpaid royalties, is when he finally found out who ratted him out to Vince McMahon. He said, when I sued Vince, we had to depose him. I told my lawyer the story, and in the deposition, you can bring up anything you want. I said, you know what, David, if you can, find out who ratted me out. I said, find out who ratted me out that day because it was one of the boys, because there were no agents around. And so when he got in the room, he said, Mr. McMahon, has there ever been a union in wrestling? Vince says, no. And the lawyer asks, has anybody ever tried to form one? And Vince sat for a minute, and he says, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, Jesse Ventura spouted his mouth off about it once years ago. And my attorney goes, well, how do you know that? Did you hear him? No? Well, how do you know he spouted his mouth off? And he says, he didn't even hesitate. Hulk Hogan told me. It was like someone punched me in the face. This was my friend, and I thought Hogan betrayed me. Hogan called Vince and ratted me out. He was an office stooge. In my day, that's what they were called. That was a lowlife, someone who reports to the office in the old days, and it stunned me. I sat there in the chair and I couldn't even think that it was Hogan. Then Vince admitted it on Larry King as well. And there's no reason for him to lie. He's under sworn oath. Then Hogan continued to lie about it and say he didn't do it, and I've never spoken to him since, and I don't care to, because in my opinion, Hogan sold me out. Then I found out in the trial why that was. We got the financial records for WrestleMania 3, the big one, him and Andre. Hogan made more money than all of us combined, including Andre. If you took the payoffs of Andre and the whole rest of the card, Hogan made more than we did. So naturally, he did not want a union. That's when the picture became crystal clear to me that he sold us out because he was getting taken care of and he didn't want anybody else getting in on the good deal that he had. 29 years ago this week, on April 5th, 1992, one of my favorite WrestleManias, WrestleMania 8, took place at the Hoosier Dome in Indianapolis. Business was very soft for WWE at the time. They were dealing with all sorts of PR nightmares, Hulk Hogan's disastrous Arsenio Hall interview, all the various sex scandals and allegations, steroid heat coming and, you know, from the government and all that, so it was a tough time for the company. They had 62,000 fans in the building. 15,000 of those tickets, though, were given away for free. But that still means they sold 47,000 tickets, which is still pretty good. Shawn Michaels wrestled El Matador instead of his planned match with Marty Jannetty after Jannetty was suspended weeks after the barbershop incident aired on TV. So they taped the barbershop incident in December of 91. It aired on television in January of 92, I think that second week in January. By the end of January, Jannetty got in some legal trouble. I've talked about what happened there before, him and this girl at a club, and there was some shit that went down. And it got him in some legal hot water, landed him under house arrest, and so he was indefinitely suspended by the company. They did bring him back later in the year. But we were deprived of a Shawn Michaels-Marty Jannetty match at WrestleMania because of it. Jake Roberts said that he was promised a spot behind the scenes in the same position, in fact, that Pat Patterson had occupied as Vince McMahon's right-hand man, kind of a creative role behind the scenes. And when Patterson supposedly resigned around this time with all the scandals going on, he went to Vince and said, well, where's my spot? He was told, we're not filling that spot out of respect to Pat. Of course, Vince McMahon probably already knew he was going to bring Patterson back. A lot of people don't even believe that Patterson ever really left. But Vince McMahon did bring Pat Patterson back not too long after. So Jake felt that he was lied to and betrayed, and he demanded his release before he would go out to the ring for his match with The Undertaker. If they didn't give him his release, he was going to walk out and not do the match. And so he got his release, and he did the job. Roddy Piper did a rare job for Bret Hart, dropping the Intercontinental title back to him in a match where Bret bladed, which is a no-no at the time. They had a strict no-blood policy in the World Wrestling Federation. He did not get in trouble for it, though, because he did such a good job of concealing it and convincing everybody that it was a hard-way cut. You know, Bret also talked in his book about throwing Shane McMahon up against the wall in a bar the night before when he learned that Shane had made a pass at his wife, Julie, and had put his hands on her, not realizing that she was Bret's wife. And Bret said he wasn't going to beat him up, he just wanted to scare the life out of him so he wouldn't do that again. So anyway, Bret bladed in this match, right? He kept the razor blade in his mouth. And I hear stories of this. You know, wrestlers used to have blades in their wrist tape, or they would have it taped to their finger. The referee, in some cases, would pass the blade over to them in the middle of a match, very discreetly. But then you have stories of guys like Bret in this case who would keep the razor blades in their mouth. All the things to hide in your mouth. A razor blade should not be one of them. What if you swallow it by accident? He and Piper, they got to the back and they put on this little act to make it seem like Piper was very apologetic. He caught Bret with a kick to the, I think it was a kick to the face. And they did a very convincing job. They were working the boys, and they were working Vince McMahon in the back, and everybody believed that it was a legitimate accident. Ric Flair, he was not so lucky. And when he did the same, he bladed in his title defense against Randy Savage. He got chewed out by Vince McMahon over it in the back, and he was fined a few $1,000s as a result. This was Flair's first WrestleMania match, originally announced on television as a dream match against Hulk Hogan. That was never actually the plan, even though they announced it. Plan was always to do a split main event with Hogan against Sid coming out of that Royal Rumble finish, and Flair defending the title against the Macho Man, and threatening to reveal a centerfold photo of Savage's wife, the lovely Elizabeth. Sadly, we never got to see. Young Sala Monster was very much looking forward to seeing that photo of Elizabeth, my first crush. By the way, this show is where the Gorilla Monsoon soundbite comes from that you hear at the beginning of every history segment when you listen to the full shows on the feed. I have that little soundbite at the beginning. You hear Monsoon shouting, "History has been made." It's from the aftermath of that Ric Flair-Randy Savage match at WrestleMania 8. And in what was billed as possibly the final match of Hulk Hogan's career, Hogan beat Sid Justice by disqualification after Sid's manager, Harvey Whippleman, jumped into the ring. The finish was botched. The finish was supposed to be a Papa Shango run-in for the DQ, which would then lead to the Ultimate Warrior making his big return. But he was sent out too late. This is what Godfather had to say about it on the Scheduled for Two Falls podcast. He said, "That night, I never heard anything from anybody at all. I was so involved in what I was doing at the time, working with Hogan, Sid, Warrior. I wasn't really concerned. The problem is that they knew I was green, so they were going, 'Don't go until we tell you to go.' And so, for whatever reason, I got the cue late. I didn't know. I'm there at the curtain like a track star getting ready to run, and it was a long way to the ring. So then they say, 'Go, go, 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 go.' And I went. Once I got there, I was like, 'Oh shit, what's going on?' Because I wasn't watching the monitors. I never heard anything about it for years. I'm doing autograph signings and people are like, 'Hey, what happened when you missed your cue at WrestleMania?' And I'm like, 'No, I didn't. What do you mean?' So then I started checking into it and I'm like, 'Oh shit, I never heard it from any person, not even Undertaker. And do you know why? Because it wasn't my fault. I never even knew about it.'" He said Undertaker because he and Undertaker were tight. They were very good friends. So apparently, he didn't even know about it until years later when the fans started asking him questions about it. But if you were watching the pay-per-view that night, it was pretty apparent that Papa Shango got the late cue. Match was already over, and here he comes, kind of stumbling down the aisle. Warrior return, he was looking a lot slimmer than we had last seen him. Even though this is one of my personal favorite WrestleManias, this is the one that always stands out to me as the biggest what-if. There have been a lot of what-if matches over the years that we thought we might get or that were originally planned but didn't happen at WrestleMania. This entire card is practically one big what-if. It's the one that I fantasy booked the most when I think about what the card could have been. It could have been Hogan against Flair for the title. And they had their reasons for not doing it. They did some house show matches. It didn't do great. I've heard all the stories before. Hogan, Flair, and the main event of WrestleMania would have been a big match. That is what the match should have been. You could have done Hogan against Flair for the title. You could have had the blow-off between the Macho Man and Jake the Snake in their feud. Make it loser leaves the WWF once Jake knew that he wanted out. Although that might have happened at the last minute. But you should have had that. That feud deserved a proper blow-off, not on some TV special. That match deserved a blow-off at WrestleMania. You could do Undertaker against Sid. You can keep Bret Hart one-on-one against Roddy Piper. If Jannetty didn't screw up, they could have done Shawn Michaels against Marty Jannetty, and it probably would have been a hell of an opener. LOD. They should have been defending the tag team titles, maybe against Money Inc., had Hawk not been popped on a drug test, which is why they were relegated to an interview segment on the show. I mean, just up and down the card, this card could have been so much better than it was, but it's still one of my favorites. 24 years ago this week on April 6th, 1997, WCW held its Spring Stampede pay-per-view from Tupelo, Mississippi. A largely uneventful show, even Hulk Hogan did not appear. But his name was invoked in one of the most memorable segments in WCW history, one of the most infamous. There was a Four Corners number one contender match involving Lex Luger, the Giant, Booker T, and Stevie Ray of Harlem Heat. The winner would challenge Hogan at a later date for the WCW World Heavyweight title. Actually, I think Luger got the win, and I believe Luger got the title match. I think it was the title match in August. It was like 5 months later when he beat Hogan on Nitro, 6 days before their pay-per-view, and he won the world title. It was this great moment in Nitro history. I believe Luger got that match because of winning this Four Corners match here on this show. But I don't remember a thing about the match. I do remember the promo leading up to it that ended with Booker saying, "Hulk Hogan, we coming for you." Followed by a slang version of the N-word. Booker says he immediately regretted it. He almost put his head in his hands if you watch it back. Sherry was managing Harlem Heat at the time, and she was trying to calm Booker down and basically be like, it's all good. She was a total pro in that segment, just trying to keep his head cool, because you could see Booker knew right away what he had done. Stevie Ray never flinched. Stevie Ray had the sunglasses on. He just stood there. He didn't flinch. Neither did Mean Gene, but Booker knew what he did, and he had Hogan as a guest on his radio show not too long ago. And he told Hogan, he said it was the worst moment of his life. He thought it was the end of his career. He thought he was going to be fired over it. And he also asked Hogan, he said, why weren't you angry about it? Why weren't you upset? Why didn't you try to get me fired? You know, what was up with that? And I'm sure Hogan was probably thinking, what's the big deal, brother? Of course he didn't think it was a big deal. Now it all makes sense, looking back on it. That is one of the more infamous moments in WCW history, and the one I'm sure that Booker T gets asked about more than anything else. 5 days later, on April 11th, 1997, while on a WWE tour of Kuwait, Vader and The Undertaker appeared on a morning television show called Good Morning Kuwait. And when the host decided to ask Undertaker if what they did was fake, if it was acting, Undertaker was very diplomatic in his answer. Vader was not so diplomatic. Now, Vader claims the producer of the show was friends with the interviewer, he was friends with the host, and the producer asked the wrestlers to really ham it up after the host asked that question, and Vader says he was told point blank, you know, toss some furniture, grab the guy by his tie. These are all things that Vader ended up doing. Plus, he got up in the interviewer's face asking if he thought this was fake. He even dropped an F-bomb live on the air. But he claims that the producer never bothered to clue in the host about what he was going to do, and the guy was scared to death. You can tell just by watching it. He thinks maybe the producer was trying to play a prank on his friend. Who knows? But he wasn't really angry. He was only doing what he was told to do. He said Dave Hebner was standing right there, off camera, when the producer told him what to do. He went and he left the studio when it was over, and he wrestled The Undertaker that night, as scheduled. And the very next day, the host pressed charges against him. So Vader had to go find himself a lawyer, but the next day was the start of a 2-week religious holiday, so the courts were closed. He was going to have to wait it out, even though the rest of the roster was able to return home. You know, I'd be shitting bricks if they left me behind by myself with charges pending in a foreign country. But contrary to popular belief, he was not thrown in jail. He was detained under house arrest for 2 weeks in a $600 a night resort where he basically had the run of the place. He said he even got a tan during that time. WWE aired these Vader held hostage in Kuwait updates on television to try to really milk as much publicity out of it as they could, to the point where people thought the whole thing might just be a work. Eric Bischoff said he thought the thing was a hoax. Gerald Briscoe told a story to JBL a few years ago that had never been told before, alleging that U.S. Special Forces in Kuwait offered to smuggle Vader out of the country before his court appearance. They were going to hide him in a cargo container. It's very hard for me to imagine one smuggling a 450-pound man and hiding him anywhere, but they would hide him in a cargo container and get him to France. And then from France, he would take a commercial flight back to the States. Ultimately, Briscoe decided it was not wise to do that. It was not wise to risk getting caught smuggling someone out of the country illegally. And in the end, Vader paid a $120 fine and he was allowed to go back home. The talk show host refused to drop the charges, and he lost his job over it. And in 1999, so 2 years later, the host sued WWE for $1 million for showing the footage of the incident on television, causing him great Great embarrassment and great distress, he claimed. I looked and tried to find any record of how or if that lawsuit was ever settled. I couldn't find anything, but I definitely remember the Vader held hostage updates on TV. I think they even put this graphic with jail bars over his face as they gave the update. 12 years ago this week on April 5th, 2009, what WWE billed as the 25th anniversary of WrestleMania, which was actually the 24th anniversary, but I guess the 25th anniversary sounds a lot better. WrestleMania 25 from Reliant Stadium in Houston, Texas, brought us, in my opinion, the greatest WrestleMania match of all time between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. I love the heaven against hell theme for this match. I was more surprised it took them this long to put these two together for a match. It was their first singles match against each other since their casket match at the Royal Rumble 11 years earlier. They were part of the finish of the 2007 Royal Rumble. They opened the 2008 Royal Rumble match, but this was their first one-on-one meeting since Shawn Michaels returned from his back injury many, many years earlier. And there's a lot of great moments in this match. Of course, there is the botched dive spot where Undertaker almost died. Sim Snuka was playing cameraman, the former Deuce of Deuce and Domino fame. He was the cameraman who was supposed to catch Undertaker, and he did not. He was pulled in the way. He was out of position. Whoever you want to blame for it, everyone involved is very fortunate. Undertaker, most of all. You got a guy who's 6'10", 6'9", legit, 325 pounds, diving through the air, landing right on the back of his head. He was concussed. It could have been a lot worse. He could have been paralyzed. It was very scary, but it's become part of the lore of the match. The fact that he was able to kind of recover and continue on. We had Undertaker, his reaction, that memorable facial expression when Shawn Michaels kicked out of the first tombstone. Shawn Michaels had this great super kick near fall. Very dramatic. You look at the reaction of the fans in the first three rows when he kicked out. Oh, this match was just wrestling bliss. We had the moonsault from Shawn Michaels into the tombstone for the finish, which Michaels practiced earlier. He couldn't hit that moonsault quite right, as the referee recalls. And so Michaels was very worried that he wasn't going to be able to hit the moonsault. But of course, during game time, once the little red light goes on and you go out in front of that crowd, if you're Shawn Michaels and you're in that zone, I mean, there's a reason why he had the kind of matches he used to have. So for him, it was no big thing. He hit that moonsault perfectly. Marty Elias was the referee for the match. He remembers coming back through the curtain, and everybody is giving them a standing ovation, and he can remember Shane Helms saying, "Oh my God, if there's a mercy rule in pro wrestling, they need to pull it right now, because nobody is following that match." And indeed, nobody could. Nobody could follow that match. Triple H and Randy Orton even said they knew that they couldn't. They knew they were fucked. The minute that match was over, they knew they were screwed in the main event. This is the match, in hindsight, that should have gone on last. They did make up for their mistake, though, the following year by putting their match on last. But this is the match that should have headlined WrestleMania that year, for sure. Also on this show, there was supposed to be a unification match for the Raw and SmackDown tag team titles, pitting Miz and Morrison against Carlito and Primo, which was bumped up to the pre-show. John Morrison noted they all found out about it about a week or two before. They were told it was because Kid Rock, who was performing that night, wanted a ridiculous amount of time for his little mini-concert. So they had to give time to Kid Rock, which bumped the title unification match. It's nice to see this company had their priorities straight. And Chris Jericho got knocked out by Mickey Rourke after Jericho's handicap elimination match with the legends Jimmy Snuka, Ricky Steamboat, and Roddy Piper. I already talked about the whole Jericho-Mickey Rourke thing a few weeks ago. They had reached an agreement. Secretly, Vince McMahon had reached an agreement with Mickey Rourke for a match that he would have with Chris Jericho at WrestleMania, but Rourke spilled the beans a little too early on the red carpet, and he ended up being talked out of doing it by his people because his people thought that it might hurt his chances at winning an Oscar for his performance that year in the movie The Wrestler. So we never did get that match between Chris Jericho and Mickey Rourke. 10 years ago this week on April 11th, 2011, Edge stood in the middle of the ring on Monday Night Raw and announced that he was being forced into retirement after an MRI showed that he was risking paralysis or death by continuing to wrestle with his spinal stenosis. He was, at that time, the World Heavyweight Champion. He had just successfully defended his title at WrestleMania. It took 9 years, but he did eventually return to the ring after receiving an offer from Tony Khan to come work for AEW. Come work for us behind the scenes. We'll let you do a few matches each year. Edge, out of respect and out of loyalty, felt he had to at least tell Vince McMahon about the offer that was made. And wouldn't you know, Vince McMahon said, you know, if you're going to wrestle again, it's not going to be for them. It's going to be for us. It's going to be in a WWE ring. And all of a sudden, the man who was told he would never be cleared to wrestle again magically got cleared. And he made his return to the ring. 8 years ago this week, on April 7, 2013, WrestleMania 29 was held from MetLife Stadium in New Jersey, twice in a lifetime. A show that saw Mark Henry literally fall on top of Ryback for the win in their match. A finish that Ryback is convinced was done to embarrass him. Of course it was. I knew that. I was in the building that night. I knew that the moment the referee counted three. I said, this guy looks like a fucking idiot. And then, after making him look like a loser, they turned him heel the next night, and they feuded him with John Cena for the championship, knowing full well that this guy was finished. Chris Jericho worked with Fandango in Fandango's debut match, but Jericho was not very happy about it. He believed that he would be working with Ryback originally on this show, while Ryback still actually had some momentum. When he found out about the change, he called Undertaker to ask his advice on what he thought he should do, and Undertaker told him, what do I think? Do it. You just got to do what the boss tells you to do, and if you do a good enough job, he'll take care of you. Undertaker went to 21-0 with a win over CM Punk in what I thought was the best match of the night, I mean, easily. But it wasn't always supposed to go that way. The Rock, if he is to be believed, in an interview 5 years ago on the set of his movie Jumanji, Rock said the original plan was for him to beat Punk for the title at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view, not the Royal Rumble like he did. That would have then led to a triple threat match at WrestleMania with Rock, Cena, and CM Punk, but ultimately he says it was not his call to make. It would have made for a much better match, I'll tell you that. As it was, Rock suffered some pretty bad injuries in his rematch with John Cena. On that first attitude adjustment of the match, Rock tore his abdominal and his adductor muscles and also suffered a hernia. He was a mess. When that match was over, he needed surgery. This killed off their plans to shoot an angle on Raw the next night to set up a match for the following year's WrestleMania in New Orleans with The Rock and Brock Lesnar. And it's one of those what-if questions that we'll never know the answer to. If Rock stays healthy and is not injured, and he does the angle the next night, and he wrestles Brock as planned, as originally scheduled at WrestleMania 30, does the Undertaker streak remain intact? You know, Vince McMahon said it himself, both to the Undertaker and to Steve Austin when he did that podcast interview with him. He didn't think there was anybody believable outside of Lesnar who could have been the one to break the streak. Now, maybe Undertaker goes to 22-0 that year and then loses to someone else, or maybe he doesn't lose at all. If Vince doesn't think there's anyone else who's credible enough to beat him, maybe he leaves the streak alone. We'll never know. The next day, it was reported that Rebecca Quinn had signed a 2-year developmental deal with WWE, and in August she would start going by her new ring name of Becky Lynch. Later that night on Monday Night Raw, Dolph Ziggler cashed in his Money in the Bank contract on Alberto Del Dipshit to win the World Heavyweight title in, for my money, the greatest Money in the Bank cash-in of all time. You know, the Seth Rollins one at WrestleMania is more iconic. It's more significant because it happened in the main event of WrestleMania in front of a big audience like that. I was lucky enough to be in the building for both of those. And I can tell you that when Ziggler cashed in and he won, So first was the cash-in. Then the bell rung and the match happened, and then he actually won the match. The building was shaking. The Izod Center was literally shaking. It's one of the greatest things I've ever been part of as a wrestling fan at any of these shows that I've ever attended. Ziggler tweeted on the anniversary this week, 8 years ago, one of the most amazing pieces of business in the history of our sport. 4 minutes of an MFing Picasso unfolding before your eyes. All because the fans refused to be told who to cheer for. Cheers to you all. 7 years ago, on April 6th, 2014, playing off that very same theme of the fans refusing to do what they're told, WrestleMania 30 from the Superdome, not Silverdome, Hogan, in New Orleans. The best WrestleMania in the last decade, in this man's opinion. It was all about the Daniel Bryan story. That story may never have been told were it not for CM Punk walking out on the company the day after the Royal Rumble. Punk was scheduled to wrestle Triple H that year at WrestleMania, and he was even going to win, or at least that's what he was told, but he decided to leave anyway. And that, coupled with the fans turning against the returning Batista, turned their plans upside down. The fans badly wanted Daniel Bryan to regain the championship that he had been screwed out of by the Authority the previous summer. But Bryan was not in their Mania plans. In fact, he says in his book that he was originally booked in a match sixth from the top against Sheamus that year. They were handed the easiest story in the world to tell. You know, for a company that likes to fancy themselves, oh, we're storytellers. They were gifted the greatest possible story they could have had. And only told that story after their hand was forced into doing so. It's like someone who drops a $20 bill in the street, only to find a 50 laying on the sidewalk right around the corner. They lucked into this storyline. They were badly misguided, bringing Batista back when they did to win the Royal Rumble. Nobody wanted to see Batista win over Daniel Bryan. I say nobody. I mean, there were some people who didn't like Daniel Bryan, thought he was too small. He looks like a goat. Not everybody was a Daniel Bryan fan, but by and large, fan sentiment, certainly in the buildings, they weren't looking to see Batista win the Royal Rumble. I think they would have been fine with Batista coming back. But of all the times to, you know, book a Batista win like that, you do it at a time when that Royal Rumble, I mean, it was a slam dunk. It should have been the easiest thing in the world. Even Big Dave knew it. He wanted to be a heel. They said, no, we're going to bring you back as a babyface. Even he was smart enough to know. He saw the writing on the wall. He knew what was going to happen. And when he won the Rumble to win that match with Randy Orton at WrestleMania, and Bryan was not even in the match, the fans rebelled. Batista ended up turning heel later on anyway, and Bryan was ultimately added to the match, provided, of course, he could first beat Triple H, which he did at the beginning of the show. Actually, the show opened with Hulk Hogan, Steve Austin, and The Rock in the ring together for a promo segment. Bryan beat Triple H to advance to the main event. Cesaro body slammed Big Show out of the ring to win the inaugural Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal, and was immediately linked up with Paul Heyman on TV the next night, a pairing that was dissolved very quickly and went absolutely nowhere. John Cena pinned Bray Wyatt in a match that he absolutely did not need to win. The Undertaker was concussed mere minutes into his match with Brock Lesnar, which saw Lesnar end the streak at 21-1. And it was the most bizarre thing that I have ever been a part of at a wrestling show. Just the reaction to the finish. We all thought the referee botched the count, especially when the bell rang and they didn't play anyone's theme music. It was as if they were confused, trying to figure out what to do next. I'll bet the referee was confused. Nobody clued him in. Chad Patton, nobody clued him in as to the finish. Can you believe that? I'm not even sure I 100% buy into that story. Because when you're handling something so delicate, you only have one shot to do this, right? To break the streak. You're going to leave it in the hands of the referee without giving him any kind of cue as to what he should be doing? Just imagine being that referee when you make that three count. Imagine being that referee when your hand hits three and there's this mass confusion and you're just hoping you did the right thing. All I could do was just laugh at the stupidity of ending the streak at all, which is why when they were panning around for all the shocked reactions, you see my face in the lower right-hand corner, just before the announcement, the ring announcement, and I'm smiling. I'm the only person apparently who found humor in this, and it wasn't that I was happy about it. I just couldn't believe how stupid they were to actually do it. Undertaker was so badly concussed, he has no memory of the match. His last memory that day was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it picks up at 5 in the morning in the hospital. When he came back through the curtain, he collapsed. He had to be taken from the building in an ambulance. Vince McMahon went with him. He missed the main event of the show. When he got to the building that day, Undertaker thought he was going over. That's how late of a decision it was for this streak to come to an end. And he was not necessarily happy about it, but his attitude was, if that's what the boss wants, then so be it. He just wanted to know. He says, are you sure? And Vince says, I'm sure. So he didn't fight it. He went along with it. But when he got to the Superdome that day, he believed that he was winning and going over in that match. And in an excellent main event, Daniel Bryan won the World Heavyweight title in a triple threat match against the champion Randy Orton and the challenger Batista, tapping out Batista in the S-lock. Michael Cole, and as I'm recording this, Michael Cole just last night on night one of WrestleMania botched the main event call in the Sasha Banks-Bianca Belair match. But I will give him credit here. Michael Cole had this great call at the end of the triple threat match, calling it the Miracle on Bourbon Street. He was going nuts. I thought that was a very good call. The next night on Raw, Paige made her main roster WWE debut, pinning AJ Lee in just over a minute. Didn't go very long. Pinned her to win the Divas Championship, ending AJ's run at a then-record 295 days, a record topped by Nikki Bella a little over a year later. Because, you know, we gotta wipe the memory clean of AJ Lee, because she's associated with that icky CM Punk guy. So Nikki Bella will go down as the longest reigning Divas Champion of all time. With the win, Paige became the youngest woman at 21 years of age to ever hold gold in WWE. And the Ultimate Warrior returned to WWE that weekend to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. He was back on good terms with the company. They were working on a whole bunch of merchandising ideas for him. And he goes into the Hall of Fame. He makes an appearance before the live crowd at WrestleMania. But then he comes back for a promo segment on Raw the next night. He returned for one final appearance in the ring for a promo that is incredibly haunting now, looking back. He said, no WWE talent becomes a legend on their own. Every man's heart one day beats its final beat. His lungs breathe its final breath. And if what that man did in his life makes the blood pulse through the body of others and makes them bleed deeper and believe in something larger than life, then his essence, his spirit, will be immortalized by the storytellers, by the loyalty, by the memory of those who honor him and make the running the man did live forever. You are the legend makers of Ultimate Warrior. In the back, I see many potential legends, some of them with warrior spirits. You will do the same for them. You will decide if they lived with the passion and intensity, so much so that you will tell your stories and you will make them legends as well. You are the Ultimate Warrior fans, and the spirit of Ultimate Warrior will run forever. He looked like he was struggling to catch his breath. He was sweating. He did not look good. And little did we all know that the very next day, while walking to his car with his wife outside their hotel in Arizona, he would clutch his chest and collapse after suffering a fatal heart attack at the age of 54. 3 years ago this week on April 8th, 2018, WrestleMania 34 was back at the Superdome in New Orleans with John Cena in the crowd as a fan. Although he did end up wrestling Undertaker later in the show in a quick 2 minute 45 second squash. As in, John Cena was the one who got squashed at WrestleMania. Braun Strowman chose a 10-year-old boy named Nicholas out of the crowd to be his tag team partner in a title match against Sheamus and Cesaro. And won. They won the tag team titles. Before Nicholas promptly vacated the title the next day due to prior commitments that he had with school. Nicholas, by the way, is the son of WWE referee John Cone. AJ Styles retained his WWE Championship over the Royal Rumble winner that year, Shinsuke Nakamura, in a Wrestle Kingdom 10 rematch that I and a lot of other people I know were looking forward to. They had a good match. It did not live up to their previous match in Japan, but it was still a good match. Nakamura subsequently turned heel when the match was over and hit Styles low right in the balls. The first of many times AJ would get his balls bounced in their feud. And at no point during this entire program did he think to wear a cup. He had many opportunities to go purchase a cup from any Modells he could have walked in, or Dick's Sporting Goods. Could have jumped on Amazon. Could have bought a six-pack of those things. Nope. Kept getting hit in the balls. Okada, Tanahashi, and Minoru Suzuki of New Japan Pro Wrestling were all in attendance at the Superdome that night to watch Nakamura challenge for the title. They were in town. There were some other shows going on, so that's why they were in town. But they were there to see their boy. They were there to see Nakamura challenging for the championship. Tanahashi was in the crowd laughing his ass off at the Nakamura turn at the very end. And apparently when Braun Strowman was looking for a tag team partner and he was surveying the crowd at first, Tanahashi was seen raising his hand in the air. Can you even imagine? If Braun if the whole thing was kind of on the up and up, and Braun was like, they told Braun, you could pick anybody you want. And Braun looks over and sees Tanahashi, probably not even knowing who he is, and picks on him. And Tanahashi's like, well, I guess I must go to the ring. And Braun Strowman brings Hiroshi Tanahashi into the ring as his tag team partner. Or Suzuki, even better. Bring Minoru Suzuki in there. I'll bet Cesaro would have known who that was. Ronda Rousey made her in-ring debut, tagging with Kurt Angle in a successful effort against Triple H and Stephanie McMahon. Stephanie's first ever WrestleMania match. This was the match of the night. This wasn't just the match of the night. This was one of the WWE matches of the year. It is seriously in the conversation for greatest in-ring debuts of all time. And it took something like six F5s in the main event, but Brock Lesnar retained his WWE Universal title over Roman Reigns, much to the delight of the people in my section. I don't know if my section was representative of everybody else in the Superdome that night, but there were a lot of very surprised, very happy people when Brock Lesnar went over clean the way he did in the main event. Again, it's a rare thing to see the heel come in, although you could argue Roman Reigns was the heel that night. That's certainly not how WWE was portraying him, but there were a lot of very happy people when Brock Lesnar retained that title. 1 year later, on April 6th, 2019, Ring of Honor and New Japan Pro Wrestling joined forces for their G1 Supercard from Madison Square Garden, which WWE unsuccessfully tried to stop from happening. It was the first pro wrestling event not owned by the McMahon family to be held at MSG since 1960. So you can see why they would not have wanted anyone in their backyard. It really was the tale of two shows. The Ring of Honor portion just was not very good, and the fans were mostly there to see New Japan anyway. And I think that part of the show delivered. It was actually quite great. Kota Ibushi beat Tetsuya Naito to win the IWGP Intercontinental Championship. And Kazuchika Okada retained the IWGP Heavyweight title from Jay White. On the Ring of Honor side, Matt Taven beat Jay Lethal and Marty Skrull in a ladder match to capture the Ring of Honor world title. And I can tell you, he was not a popular choice in the building at that time. The next day, WrestleMania 35 was back at MetLife Stadium. Seth Rollins opened the show with a WWE title win over Brock Lesnar. Triple H beat Batista in Batista's final match. For all that Triple H did for him in his career, Batista always wanted one last match against Triple H, and he got his wish. Kurt Angle lost to Baron Corbin in his final match, which was an incredible waste of Kurt Angle's final match. Kofi Kingston beat Daniel Bryan to win the WWE Championship. This was the highlight of the show for me and a lot of people, I think. A very emotional moment watching Kofi hold that belt up and to see him celebrating in the ring after with his son, Big E, and Xavier Woods were crying. Those tears were very real that night. And in the first ever women's main event in WrestleMania history, a winner-take-all triple threat title match, Becky Lynch became Becky Two Belts, beating Charlotte Flair and Ronda Rousey in a match that did not even go to the ring until midnight. A 7.5-hour show this was. Ridiculous. It's disgusting. After the event was over, fans who had taken New Jersey Transit to the event were forced to stand out in the rain for hours on end. The transit agency had been told that the show would be over by 10:30. I don't know who told them that, but that person's a friggin' idiot. And when it ran 2 hours later than expected, a lot of their staff had already gone home. They had fulfilled their work hours, and they took off and they went back home. New Jersey Transit expected anywhere from 8,000 to 13,000 riders that night. And instead, they were met by over 30,000 when the show was over. And that is this week in wrestling history. Hope you enjoyed that trip down memory lane as always. Always have fun looking back on some of these shows and some of these incidents. I didn't realize that, you know, this week was the same week in history of the McDonald's incident with Ken Patera and the Vader incident in Kuwait. What will we find next week? I'm actually very interested as I start to put my notes together this week to see what exactly happened this upcoming week in history. And as I do every week, I will bring it to you on episode 700. Can you believe that? We got people listening to this podcast since episode 1. I'm talking to all you guys. Can you believe that next week is going to be 700 of these things that I've done? I mean, I've done a lot more than 700. But in terms of the episodes that have numbers attached to it, the regular Sunday show, not all the extra stuff I do, 700 shows. If you would have told me I'd have 700 episodes when I started doing this thing, I don't think I would have believed you. But here we are. I'll do one quick question because Alberto wrote in from Laredo, Texas. I want to just answer this real quick. TheSoloMonster@gmail.com, by the way, is where you can send all of your mailbag questions. Alberto, from Laredo, Texas. If Shawn Michaels is Mr. WrestleMania, who would you say is Ms. or Mrs. WrestleMania? And don't say Santina Marella from WrestleMania 25. Well, since you took my answer away from me, Charlotte Flair. Charlotte Flair is Miss WrestleMania. There really is no other woman who has even had the chance so far to have as many consistently good matches as she's had on that show. Now, Sasha Banks had a damn good match with Bianca Belair last night in the main event. But Sasha Banks, you know, she had the good triple threat with Charlotte and Becky at 32. Really, last night was the first truly great match that Sasha Banks has been able to have at WrestleMania one-on-one. So she's got a ways to go, I think, to play catch-up. As great as she is, Charlotte already has the resume on this show. She was the last Divas champion, first women's champion in the lineage of that belt. She was part of that very good triple threat with Sasha and Becky at 32. She beat Asuka in an excellent match at 34. Even if you weren't a fan of the outcome, I thought they had an excellent match. She was part of the first women's match ever to headline a WrestleMania at 35. And she had one of the best matches on either night of WrestleMania 36. For the NXT title with Rhea Ripley. I mean, really, it was either that or the Boneyard match last year. So I think even if you are someone who is not a fan of Charlotte Flair, I think you need to put that bias aside and just admit that when you really look at the body of work that she's put together relative to any other woman in the history of WrestleMania, and there really were not a whole lot of women's matches, period, at WrestleMania before the early 2000s. So it's not this huge body of work that the women have been allowed to have at WrestleMania up until fairly recently. Charlotte Flair is that person. If you're going to have a Mr. and a Ms. WrestleMania, she would be it. And maybe in 5 years it'll be Sasha or it'll be Bianca or Rhea or somebody else. But right now the answer is Charlotte Flair. Keep emailing me because next Sunday is episode 700. And I am planning on that being a regular show pretty much, but later that night, so Sunday night, April 18th, 7 days from now, we're going to be live on YouTube for a special Sound Off Inbox live edition answering your questions and your super chats. You can always send in questions that way as well if you want to support. But if you want to possibly have your question included as part of the live inbox on YouTube next Sunday, now would be a good time to drop me an email. TheSolemonster@gmail.com. I will try to pull as many questions as I can. And we'll answer a whole bunch of questions from you guys next Sunday. So you're going to get two podcasts next week for the price of one. I'm going to be live on YouTube tonight for my WrestleMania Night 2 recap as soon as the pay-per-view goes off the air. Hopefully not as late as last night. And back with you again live on Wednesday, talking AEW Dynamite. I hope you've enjoyed all the content. I've been busting my hump to try to get it out to you guys, and I'm going to be working on getting up some more retro audio for our YouTube members. If you are considering a membership on the YouTube channel, there are two pricing tiers for it. Really, you can click on any video on the channel. You'll see a white join button. Just click that button, a little video will pop up of me explaining everything to you. And on the higher price tier, those folks have access to the lost episodes of the Sound Off. The first three are already up. I'm going to be working on the audio for episode 4 and 5 this week. And so hopefully in the next few days, once I get some rest, I will be able to dive into that and work on getting that up for all of you. So there's been a lot of content. There is a lot more coming up here in the month of April. We're not done yet. But I hope you will join me live for night 2 of WrestleMania coverage tonight on YouTube. We have 3,000 people. We peaked with 3,000 live viewers last night during the night 1 stream, which is amazing, especially because the bulk of it didn't even happen until after midnight. I can't thank you enough for all of the support then. Until tonight, be well, stay safe. Have yourselves a fantastic week. Enjoy WrestleMania Night 2. Hopefully, Night 2 turns out to be as good as Night 1 was. And I will see you on YouTube as soon as the show goes off the air for your WrestleMania recap. Until then, I'll see you tonight. Take care, guys.
The Solemn Monster sounds off.
So then we had, at the very end of the show, a segment in the ring with Alexa Bliss and Randy Orton. She called him a bitch, which is their go-to word on these shows, right? Didn't we hear Kevin Owens called Roman Reigns the same thing on Friday night? He called him a bitch. Alexa Bliss here called Randy Orton a bitch. Boy, you know, I can play that game too. Hey, Vince McMahon, step aside, bitch. There, see how easy that was?
The Solemn Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolemnmonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solemn Monster on Twitter @SolemnMonster.
Solemn Monster.
Solemn Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solemn Monster sounds off.